Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
We're continuing our study in 1 Samuel. We're going to be in 1 Samuel 16 and 17 today. I think it's a very interesting study about the continuing decline of Saul and the growing preeminence of David. Some very exciting and unusual things here, and I hope you'll follow with me. Chapter 16, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel?" I think this showed something of the prophet's personal life. I think he really cared for Saul. I think it grieved him that Saul, by his own actions, was rejected. We see something of the hints of this, maybe, in chapter 10, verses 1 and 24, chapter 15, 11 and 35. You may want to check that. "I have rejected him from being king." In chapter 13 and 14, his lineage is rejected from succeeding him because of his sin with the Amalekites, not killing all of them. And then in chapter 15:23, he doesn't wait for Samuel to come and offer a sacrifice. He does it himself. And so therefore, he is rejected from being king himself. Now, so he's going to fill your horn of oil and go, and I'll send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite. Now, a horn of oil, back in chapter 9 and 10, it was a vial or some kind of holder, not a horn. Maybe it's the same thing, just different words used. Horn has the implication of power. The oil, of course, is a symbol of the calling and equipping and presence of God in one's life. Notice it mentions here in verse 2, "Now Samuel said, 'How can I go? When Saul hears of it, he will kill me.'" I think this shows something of the irrational nature of anger, angry outburst that Saul is experiencing, which we're going to talk about in this chapter. It's going to be even more intensified. Now, God tells him, don't tell everything you know. It took me a long time as a preacher to understand I didn't have to tell everybody everything I believed. I don't think it's a lie. It's just not telling the whole truth. There's something very similar to this in 1 Kings 22, 19 through 23, where God even seems to put a lying spirit in the mouth of the prophets. I think this is more an anthropological problem than a theological problem. We're speaking about God as if he was a man because we don't understand God's ways. They're a mystery to us, so we put them in terms of human ways, which really, in some cases, are not analogous. So I think that God just said, this is where we're going to do this. Right now, it's not time for Saul to be rejected. David will be safe this way. You'll be safe. Tell him you're going to offer a sacrifice and go ahead and do that also. So he takes a heifer and he goes. And he goes to the city of Bethlehem. And notice here, it's about 6 or 7 miles south of Jerusalem. And the elders of the city meet him, though we don't see them anymore. And they ask, "Do you come in peace?" What an unusual greeting for a man of God. Now, number one, maybe they felt a sense of personal sin and a reverence at the presence of the man of God. Maybe that's it. But really, I think the background is probably the growing tension between Samuel and Saul. Matter of fact, Saul's going to kill the priest at Nob when he thinks they're supporting David. You might want to see chapter 22, 11 through 19. Maybe that's the source of their reluctance and their question here. And now he says to them, "Consecrate yourself for the sacrifice." Now the word consecrate means make yourself clean, purify yourself, become holy. And there seems to be both a physical and a spiritual sense here. The physical sense can be seen in Exodus chapter 19, verse 10 and 14. And I guess uniquely in Leviticus 15. But the spiritual nature of this can be seen in Numbers 8:21, and I think you ought to look at that to see the nature. We need to prepare ourselves for worship. Maybe that's the idea. And notice it says here that he consecrated Jesse. That seems to imply Samuel did something to Jesse to make him uniquely ready for this sacrifice. What exactly he did to Jesse, we don't know. Was it a preliminary anointing? Was it a ritual bath of some kind performed by the prophet? We just really don't know. In verse 6, we have the eldest son brought first to meet Samuel. His name, Eliab, means El and Abba. God is my daddy, something like that. Surely the Lord's anointed is before me. Now that's what the Jerusalem Bible also has. Because the guy is so tall and handsome. He looks like Saul. Looks like a king ought to look. Now, we see this kind of tallness as a something the people wanted, and apparently Samuel too, in chapter 10, 9, verse 2, chapter 10, verse 23. We see this same thing in Absalom. He was a tall, a handsome man that rebelled, and some of the people followed him. God says a very wonderful thing here in verse 7. Do not look at his appearance nor the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. That's such an important spiritual truth. You know, in everything we do spiritually, God is concerned with the motive. That's what the prophetic emphasis is all about. It's not that you do the right thing in the right place at the right time. It's why you do that. Why you approach God. How your heart is. Is it soft and open and available and contrite before God? That's what God's concerned about. Let me give you some passages that I think that help clarify this, that God judges the heart. 1 Kings 8:39, 1 Chronicles 28:9, Psalms 139:1 through 4, Jeremiah 17:10, Luke 16:15, and Acts 1:24 will certainly confirm the idea that God judges the motives. Then they called the second son and the third son, and it seems that all seven of the sons came through. You might well see chapter 8, verses... there's eight sons, it says in chapter 17, verse 12. But he only really had seven. We learn that from 1 Chronicles 2:13 through 15. Well, why the discrepancy? One place seven, one place eight. Some think that one of these sons must have died young before he had any family. Maybe that does explain it. The perfect number seven, they mean the full number of kids. There are many explanations, but we got to be careful about Western literalism sometime in reading the Bible. So he brought all the sons, and Saul says, Jesse, are these all your children? He said, there remains yet the youngest. Behold, he is tending the sheep. God picked this youngest one, the one they wouldn't even have thought. He wasn't tall. He's going to be a handsome kid, but he's not tall. He's not the firstborn. Isn't that the way God always does it? Picks the one that men wouldn't to show his power and his choice. So they said, go send for him. And they're going to wait the meal. They're going to recline, but they're not going to eat. You know, we'll see the Jerusalem Bible here. They can't eat this sacrificial meal until this youngest son comes. So they brought him in, and he was ruddy. Now, the word ruddy is interesting. It comes from the word Adam. It means red. Now, the Knox translation thinks he's red in the cheeks. Other translation, like the basic English translation, says he's red-headed. I'm not real sure. Maybe he had a reddish face. We're just not sure. I kind of want to think in my mind something of a little freckle boy, but I'm not sure of that. This is even used of Esau in Genesis 25:25. He was red and hairy. He had beautiful eyes and was handsome in appearance. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. And this is the choice God tells Samuel right here. Now, Samuel anoints him, verse 13, but he doesn't tell anybody why he's anointing him. Maybe they can figure it out. So far, only priests and prophets had been anointed, and yet Saul had been anointed, the first king. Maybe they understood, wow, David's the next king. But Samuel never specifically says that. He just uniquely honors David this night. And I'm not sure they even knew what the deal really was. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him. Now, what does this mean? Well, it's kind of like the judges, how God came upon them. That wasn't a military exploit here, but everything David did began to prosper. It was an obvious sense of the presence of God with him. Now, the word David, the etymology of that word, we're unsure of. We think it may mean beloved, but we're just not sure. And so Samuel arose and went to Ramah, his hometown. Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. Oh, and look at verse 15. Look at verse 16. What a terrible thing. How do we relate this? Can God have an evil spirit? Well, we know of Satan in the Old Testament. We see him in the first two chapters of Job quite readily. We see him even in 1 Samuel 24:1, when you compare that with 1 Chronicles 21:1, that Satan caused David to number Israel. We see him in 1 Kings 22:19 through 23, the evil spirit of the Lord. It's obvious there is a spirit that accuses men. But why did the Lord spirit leave? Well, it seems he left Saul and went to David. Showed the choice of God. Well, is the evil spirit a demon? Now, that's the question I want to ask you. Well, it seems here when it says the evil spirit of the Lord terrorized him, but look at the end of verse 16 and look at the end of verse 23. Music calmed him. Music made the evil spirit go away. The Knox translation in verse 14 says, the evil mood. Now, this evil mood, in my opinion, fits this context better, where music will be a psychological salve. Now, I believe in the demonic from the New Testament. And I have no problem of the demonic in the spiritual realm. But this does not fit the demonic. It fits a psychological intensification of Saul's previous problem of depression and paranoia. Now, I think the reason we're doing this is kind of like we talked about earlier. It's an anthropomorphic way of speaking about God. In the Old Testament, there is only one source of both good and evil, and that's the one God. Many passages talk about God as both healing and wounding, as giving blessing and cursing, as bringing light and darkness, because there's only one source. Let me give you some of those so you can kind of get the flavor of the Old Testament that I think better fits this than us reading New Testament demonology back into this and try to prove that believers have demons or whatever, which I think we have very little scriptural support for, unless 2 Corinthians 12 about Paul. Let me give you a few. I'm just going to run down, not in order here. Ezekiel 14, beautiful passage as far as giving this truth. In Isaiah 45:7, Isaiah 54:16. You might almost see Lamentations 3:38. There's a pretty good one in Ecclesiastes 3:38. There's a pretty good one in Amos 3:6. There's a pretty good one in Job 2:10. So you might want to see those. This evil spirit appears several times through here. Now, notice, if you would, in verse 18, why do they choose David to come? Well, he's introduced to the story here as being someone who can play beautifully on the harp. Listen to the qualifications this boy has. Number one, he's a skilled musician. He writes and plays. Number two, he's a mighty man of valor. Same thing that Kish is called, Saul's father, back in chapter 9. He's a warrior. That we'll see 17:33. He's prudent in speech. He's a handsome man, and the Lord is with him. That we'll see verse 13. So they bring him to court. He begins to play. Saul sends for him. He's still keeping the flock. And we'll see chapter 14, verse 52. He brings an offering with him. A gift to the king, yes. A gift to support David, yes. Something like that. And he begins to sing. And lo and behold, it does help Saul. It eases his mind, his tension, his problems, his anger, his paranoia, his depression. We see that in verse 21. It says that Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. And that was one of the most trusted positions that you could give to someone. Saul had all of these men around him, these great warriors, but he trusted David and made David his armor bearer. Notice verse 23 where it says, "And when the evil spirit would come upon Saul, and Saul would and David would play the harp, that Saul would be refreshed." Now the root for the word refreshed and the root for the word spirit, ruah, is the same word. Maybe there's a play on here. "And he would be well, and the evil spirit would depart him." Now that fits much more a psychological problem than a demonic problem. In the New Testament, demons can cause psychological problems, but here the music seems to soothe it. I don't think a music would soothe a demonic possession. Then chapter 17 is another picture of how Saul met David, another picture of how David came to court. Some say they're contradictory, but I'll show you how I think they fit together. It's the Philistines again. They gathered for battle. They're in a geographical area in verse 1 that is mentioned in Joshua 15:35. It seems to be one of these lowland cities. It guards a pass that leads up into the hill country. That's why it's such an important place. Now, they're going to gather for battle there. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah, and they drew up battle array to encounter the Philistines. They're kind of equal this time, so they're both holding the high ridges with a valley in between. Notice verse 4. "Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines." The word champion literally means a man in between. A man in between. It's going to be, we know that this is a Philistine giant. And the Philistines are the Aegean people. They come from the Greek islands, probably. The Greeks, from Homer we learn, had a lot of these battles between champions where one person from each army would go out and fight each other and determine the victory or loss of the whole people. This reflects that idea. Now, this is really a big guy. He's 6 cubits and a span. Now, a cubit is a distance for an average man's longest finger and elbow, and a span is from the littlest finger to the thumb outstretched. If you add that up, about 18 inches and about 8 inches, you get somewhere around 9'4" to 9". The big fella. A big fella. Someone very similar to this is also mentioned in 2 Samuel 21:18 and following for a similar size giant. Now, he had a bronze helmet on his head. We're going to show his military implements because they're awesome. The man is just awesome. He's huge. He's got the best military equipment he can have. He's got huge weapons. He was clothed in a scale armor that weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. Oh my, like the scales of fish. We think this must have been about 125 pounds or so. My goodness, unbelievable. He's going to have a bronze leg guards and a bronze javelin. Now, some think from the Qumran literature that this means sword, and that seems to be probably true here. Slung between his shoulders, he could get it very, very quickly, his main weapon. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam. Now, a weaver's beam is not all that thick. It may mean that it had strings attached to it, like a weaver's beam. We learned that the ballistics of throwing a spear with a rope tied to it makes it go much faster than just holding it and chunking it. So maybe it's the weaver's beam with a rope, which you can throw it harder. That seems to be the idea here. The head, which means the flame, the shining part, the head, the metal part, weighed 600 shekels of iron. Remember, the Philistines were the only ones who had Iron Age technology. The Jews did not at this period. And this 600 shekels probably is around 15 pounds. We can't be real sure about that either. They stood and shouted at the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why don't you come out and draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine?" Now, the New English Bible here has the idea of the Philistine champion, and that seems to be the implication here. "And you are the slaves of Saul." Notice the rhetoric here. "Choose a man for yourselves and let him come out for me." Now notice that in verse 9 it says, "And whoever wins, the other will be the slaves." Okay, that's the deal. But, "And he did this day after day after day, but no one came out." We learn later in verse 16, it was 40 days, over a month, this guy came every morning, every evening, taunted them, psychological battle, try to get them to either get so upset they'll leave their fortified positions. Now, notice in verse 12, by the way, well, I'm gonna hold off on my comment about the Vaticanus till just a minute. "And David, the son of the Ephraimite, Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse, had 8 sons, and Jesse was old in days of Saul, advanced in years among men." There's a textual problem here. We're not exactly sure what it means advanced among men or advanced in years. My New American Standard puts the word years in italics and kind of combines both options. Notice David is seen to be introduced again as if didn't know who he was. Now, for this reason, the Vaticanus, which is one of our good Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, also has a Septuagint with it, a Greek translation of the Old Testament. It simply omits verses 12 through 31, because there seem to be two accounts of how David came to know Saul. Now, I really think the answer is in verse 15 down here, where it seems that in chapter 16, David did not stay at Saul's court. He sang for Saul. He may be Saul's armor-bearer for this or that. But he went back to the flock, and he came back, and he went back to the flock. And yet in 17, he's going to come and stay. Now, I think that's the relationship between these two chapters, not two sources combined together, but there's obvious contradiction and problem here. Now, notice Eliab, the oldest brother there in verse 13, and three of the sons had gone to fight. David, the youngest, met his older brothers. The Philistine came forward. Now, his daddy told him to go and find out some news about them, right? This giant had been coming out 40 days, but Jesse didn't know anything about that, so he sent David to find out. Notice verse 18, "Bring back news of them." Now, literally, this means their pledge, which means tell me if they fulfill their task. Have they done good in the army? Are they being brave men? Are they faithful? Go find out about your older brothers. Now, I think David was so excited he left early in the morning, got there just in time for the army to be moving up to the battlefront, and lo and behold, here comes this Philistine giant out. Well, notice it says in verse 20, he approached the circle of the camp. Now, this is the outer perimeter, and it says there was shouting, war shouting. Yes, they heard the soldiers beginning to move up and shout, call out. David ran to the battle line. He left all his donkey full of bread and everything there and just ran. And he was talking with them. Behold, the champion of the Philistines, Gath came, named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, spoke these same words, and David heard them. And all the men of Israel saw the man. They fled from him, and were greatly afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel, will be the king, will enrich the man who kills him with great riches, and will give him his daughter, and make his father's house tax-free." That probably means no taxes, no drafting of people, no goods for the support the king, whatever that. Now we'll see chapter 8, verse 11 through 17. Now David began to say, tell me about this again. Tell me about this again. What will God get who kills this giant? And then David spoke to the men who were standing by, saying, what will be done? What will be done? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Philistine is the only uncircumcised people we know in the whole area that taunts the armies of the living God. Now, this living God is a phrase that is the word, what Yahweh means. Yahweh means the ever-living, only living God. It's from the Hebrew verb to be. I want to see Exodus 3:14. And here's David using his name in the living God. And so he begins to ask more and more people. Now, his brother in verse 28, the oldest, this may be just civil rivalry. It may be jealousy from David being anointed, getting a lot of attention. But the brother kind of says, will you shut up? Will you get out of here? What are you doing up here? Just bragging and talking. Just hush. And David says, I just asked him a word. But he said it to enough people that one of them went and told Saul. Saul, there's a guy out here asking a lot of questions about what you'll give to the guy who'll kill a Goliath. You want to talk to him? Yeah, bring him in. Now, in verse 33, Saul said to David, you're not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him, but for you are but a youth, while he's been a warrior from his youth. That's true. David walked in. He was a teenage boy. I think he was strong, virile, young, but he wasn't trained. He wasn't old enough to have military training. He was dressed like a shepherd, not like a soldier. Saul said, you can't fight him, son. David said, now, wait a minute. I've been keeping the sheep of God, of Jesse. Whenever a wild animal like a lion or a bear would come, God would give me strength, and I'd kill that wild animal, and I believe I can kill this giant. This is what he's going to say. I went out after him, attacked him, and rescued it from his mouth, and rose up against me. I seized him by the beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. David's using his confidence comes from two sources. Number one, his past experiences with wild animals tell him that God is with him. He has physical strength. Number two, this giant has taunted the God of Israel. God is on his side. He has been anointed. He is God's choice for something, even if he doesn't know what. And he says, I'll take on this giant. Now, Saul says, okay, good deal. Now, the guy who should have been out there fighting this giant is Saul. He was the tall one. He was the one that was God's anointed king. He was the one that had the military experience. He's the one that should have fought this giant. He's going to send this shepherd boy out there in his place? Yeah. That's exactly what he's going to do. His paranoia is again seen, his personality type. Go, and may the Lord be with you. Well, Saul, that's a nice little word. That's like go and be warm and filled. Put God's name on him, but you chicken, you wouldn't go do it yourself. Now, Saul clothed him in his armor, but David couldn't wear Saul's armor. Saul was real tall. David wasn't that tall. He had never used this weaponry before. He was just untrained as a military person. He couldn't use that. So he took his stick, his shepherd's rod in his hand, chose for himself five smooth stones. Now, some say they're the size of baseballs, but I, in my mind, think of smaller rocks. Now, this sling was an interesting thing. It wrapped around your palm. It was about a foot long, had a leather pouch here, and the other thongs came and you held it in your palm. You swung it around your head and opened your palm, and that let the rock loose. We learn from Judges chapter 20, verse 16, that some men from Benjamin could hit a target at so small, at such a long distance. This was a formidable weapon of the day. The fact that David looks so innocent, he's going to trick this giant. He walks out there, and this giant is furious. He's a youth. He's ruddy. He's kind of red-headed or red-faced, something like that. He's handsome, but he's got a stick. And the Philistine says, am I a dog that you come after me with a stick? Maybe the staff was meant to kind of throw him off from the sling he had in the other hand. I don't know. But the giant began to taunt him, I'm going to give your body to the birds of the air. David said, no, friend. I come in the name of the Lord of hosts. I'm going to give your body to the birds. You're dead meat because you taunted God. And that giant, when they got through messing around, by the way, verse 45 to me, the Lord Sabaoth, or Lord of hosts, to me is defined in a military way, and I think that's what it is. The giant was getting all his weapons together, and David ran real quick, slung that, hit him right in the forehead. Now, I don't know if the rock killed him, that might be true, or if the cutting off his head with a sword, that surely did it. Both of them, in verse 49 and verse 51, could have done it. We're not sure. Now, in 2 Samuel 21:19, it seems that somebody else may have killed this giant from Gath. But if you use the parallel in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, you see the text of 2 Samuel has been corrupted. And 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5 attributes it to David, and I think that's a much better place. struck the Philistine giant, the only place he wasn't protected right there. He cut off his head, and the Philistines were supposed to give up. Now, that was the deal, but they got scared and fled. And what they did, they left their advantageous military position on the ridge. They became easy prey. They were scared. They were fleeing, and the Israelis followed them and killed them. That's what's going to happen. Now, in verse 54, notice it says he brought the giant's skull and his weapons and put them in his tent in Jerusalem. Now, that's very unusual. What tent? You say David's tent. No, he lives in Bethlehem. Well, it was the tabernacle. It's not in Jerusalem. Could it have been Goliath's tent? Could be. It was a Jebusite city, a Canaanite city. The Philistines had much territory in that day. I really think what happened here, this is something later in history that's read back into an earlier period. Maybe David kept the skull. Later on, the city of Jerusalem will be his special capital. Maybe that's what it is. We just don't know. Verse 55 through 58, they ask Abner, his military commander, Saul does, who is this boy? Where did he come from? Who is he? Now, what is the relationship between these two encounters? Wasn't he Saul's armor bearer? Didn't he sing for Saul? Why does 55 through 58 seem to imply that this is the first time Saul met him? The answer, I think, comes over here in chapter 15. I mean, chapter 17, verse 15. David didn't stay with Saul all the time in 16. Maybe he came and sang and left. Maybe there was no reason for Abner to know who he was. Maybe they didn't recognize him in this military setting. I don't really know. I don't think it's so much a contradiction as it is that David is a singer here and David is a valiant hero warrior here, and they didn't recognize him in the different settings. Now, this is going to be the beginning. Not only is Saul going to have to marry his daughter to this young man, but this young man's preeminence and the people's love for him is going to even intensify Saul's paranoia and Saul's depression even more. And we're seeing the rise now of David from a shepherd boy to preeminence in Israel. We see Saul continuing to decline psychologically, spiritually, militarily, every way. It is true that that special equipping by God that Saul had has now been transferred to David. And it's our irony how David first appears in Saul's court. And later, it'll be his court. Well, I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.